Good afternoon. Let's call this meeting of the House Arctic Policy, Economic Development, and Tourism to order. Time now is 1:37 p.m. We're in the Ramona Barnes Room in room 124. Present is Representative Josephson, Representative Tallarico, and myself, Representative Westlake. There are no votes out here today, and let's remind everyone, as we were talking about some snacks earlier, turn your phones off or you're going to owe me some. So with us is House Record Secretary Heather Ivoy, and running the electronics for us is Tom Raymond. We have two presentations here today, and the first is by Kathleen Rehm, the co-executive director for Team Alaska at the Arctic Winter Games. We also have board member Jim Powell in the room and board president Sarah Framdom online for questions. The second presentation is going to be by Michael Black, from Black, excuse me, and that's a friend of mine. I shouldn't make that wrong, from the Alaska Native Health Consortium. So let's start with Ms. Rehm, and will you please come forward and put yourself on the record and give us your presentation, please.
Thank you, Representative Westlake and members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Rehm. I'm the co-executive director of Team Alaska Arctic Winter Games. It gives me great pleasure to share with you all an event that will make you smile by the end of this presentation, I promise. Arctic Winter Games Team Alaska. As you can see on your screen in front of you, we have a beautiful portrait of members of our Team Alaska athletes in front of the Mendel Glacier. This was taken in 2014. The purpose of my presentation today is to give you all an understanding of what the Arctic Winter Games are, how it represents the state of Alaska, and more importantly, how the Arctic Winter Games stimulate economic development and tourism in our state. You guys ready?
I'm ready.
Let's go. All right, so just a really quick briefing. Since I do not know the collective wisdom or knowledge about the Arctic Winter Games around the room, I'm going to take a few minutes to give you just the brief 411 of what Arctic Winter Games Team Alaska is. So essentially, the purpose of Team Alaska is to organize and select youth to compete in the sporting and cultural events held by the Arctic Winter Games. So what are the Arctic Winter Games? A high-profile circumpolar sporting competition for northern and Arctic athletes. So Team Alaska organizes athletes to attend the Arctic Winter Games. We were established in 1968 as a nonprofit, and we've been participating in the games since 1970. Now, this is really important for you guys to understand in terms of our incorporation, and I'll get to that in a second. So what are the Arctic Winter Games? An international biennial cultural and sporting event for youth in the circumpolar north. More importantly, the Arctic Winter Games are an opportunity for our young Alaskan athletes to experience a profound and life-changing event. For many of our young Alaskan athletes, this is the first time they have ever participated in a sporting or cultural event to the size of Arctic Winter Games. For example, the face of the young lady you see here on the screen, she is actually from Barrow. We met her on the airline charter to Nuuk for the 2016 games, to Nuuk, Greenland. She sat next to our President Emeritus, Tim Dillon. And Mr. Dillon looked at this young lady and said, "Hello, my name is Mr. Dillon. What is your name?" And they had introductions. And he said, "What sport will you be playing?" And she said, "Arctic sports. I have five brothers and sisters. I've never been out of my hometown, and I've never been on an airplane." She was so excited. This young lady did not stop smiling through the duration of Arctic Winter Games. And when people ask me why I do what I do, this is it. But the Arctic Winter Games, once you experience it firsthand, it lights you on fire. I often tell people that Arctic Winter Games changes lives, and it's true. It's absolutely true. Not a single athlete, coach, or volunteer, or community member walks away from the Arctic Winter Games unchanged in any way. So, okay, time warp, folks. in the beginning. Now, this is important because I want you all to see how Alaska has been a founding member of the Arctic Winter Games. It was actually the brainchild of Governor Wally Hickel, Stuart Hodgson, who at the time was the commissioner for the Northwest Territories, and James Smith, who's the Yukon commissioner. They all got together, and in a meeting, they decided that it was a brilliant idea to create a sporting event that held and hosted international competition for athletes that were from rural Arctic communities. In other words, we have athletes that are talented and skilled but may never have an opportunity to compete in an international venue. So let's create that venue. Let's foster sportsmanship, culture, international and cultural exchange, and at the same time, let's host the games in small Arctic communities to stimulate economy and tourism. It was a win-win. Team Alaska was founded in 1968. We competed in the very first games in 1970, which were held in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories. And this always makes me laugh. So the sports that occurred at that time were badminton, wrestling, archery. There were about 10 sports, about 500 kids that participated. Today, in 2016, we have 18 sports and over 2,000 participants total. We have grown exponentially. Excuse me while I drink some water.
Well, and this is a good time for me to also acknowledge that Representative Newman is here. We had started at, you'll be glad to know, at 1:37, you walked in at 1:39. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
The governing bodies of the Arctic Winter Games. So if you all can imagine with me, back in 1970, when these games were small and Governor Wally Hickel had this brainchild, knowing that it would grow into such a huge, in fact, the largest circumpolar north competition, there then came some governing bodies to ensure that this organization would continue. So today, we work with the International Committee, 9 delegates representing 9 countries from Team Alaska, or sorry, that represent 9 different countries in the Arctic Winter Games, and then a host community. So you can think about this host community similar to how we have our Olympics. So Team USA competes at the Olympics that are sponsored by a host community. So let's use 2014 Arctic Winter Games, for example. The International Committee would be the Olympic Committee. Team USA would be Team Alaska. And the Fairbanks Host Committee would be, say, the host committee for the Olympics. Yeah? Make sense? This is important. This is an important distinction to make because when the Arctic Winter Games are hosted here in Alaska, folks often get Team Alaska confused with the host society. So if there is funding coming down the pike, it may not necessarily be directly for Team Alaska athletes, but for the host society that is hosting the Arctic Winter Games. I want to talk to you a little bit about the delegates that participate in the Arctic Winter Games. Specifically, let me clarify that the International Committee, which you saw in the previous slide, early on distinguished between delegations that compete. You have a participating member and a guest member. Currently, to date, we have 7 participating members and 9 guest members. Alaska, Team Alaska, is a participating member. A benefit of being a participating member is that you get to bid to host the Arctic Winter Games, so your representative territory gets to bid. You are able to send a full-sized team without any reductions of numbers, along with some other voting rights and privileges, including representation of your territory on the International Committee Board. So we have 2 Alaskan representatives that sit on this International Committee. So those are the benefits of being a participating member. A guest member has limited and most importantly, is unable to host the games. So just the rundown. Alaska, we've been an initiating member since 1970 and have participated in the games since then. Greenland was a participating member for the first time, became in 2002. The Northwest Territories of Canada became a participating member again in 1970. Northern Alberta became a participating member in 1988. Yukon became a participating member in 1970. Nunavik, Quebec is a guest member of the Arctic Winter Games. Nunavut became a participating member in 2000. In 2004, the Sami people, now the Sami people is spelled S-A-P-M-I, they're people that represent Norway, Sweden, Finland, and the Kola Peninsula of Russia. They sent their first contingent to participate in cross-country skiing about in 2004, and they still participate today as guest members. Russia also sends a delegation to participate in the Arctic Winter Games, and they are also guest members. I would point out that the participating members of those seven participating members, excuse me, six participating members, including Alaska, those participating members, in order to be a full participating member, they have to pay an initiation fee to the International Committee. All of the contingents that are participating members, the government pays that participation fee in order to ensure that they are full participating members, except for Alaska. We are a nonprofit organization, and therefore we fundraise. Are there any questions about that before I move on?
Any questions for the members? We are good.
You guys are a tough crowd. Okay, this is the exciting part. So, Alaska hosting the Arctic Winter Games. We are on approximately a 10-year cycle of hosting the Arctic Winter Games. You can see there are a few years that deviated there. But our next games, and excuse me, that is a typo. That's supposed to say 2014, Fairbanks. We are slotted to host the Arctic Winter Games in 2024. Now, the most amazing thing about being able to host the Arctic Winter Games is that your town size doubles, even quadruples, during the week of the games. So let me paint a visual illustration for you. The year before the games, the host society organizes in that particular community and hires on a staff of between 50 to 75 people to manage and run the games. Grants are applied for, infrastructure is built. For example, in the city of Kenai in 2006, when they hosted the games, a ton of new buildings were built. There was a hockey rink that was built, infrastructure that still exists in Kenai today and that athletes in the community still use today. Jobs were created. Jobs were created during the games that then also developed into leadership positions within those towns later on. So that's the leading up to the games. The week of the games itself, if you have a village of, say, 4,000 people, imagine doubling that to 8,000 people. 2,000 of those people are kids. So I guarantee you that every single grocery store is going to be experiencing a shortage of cookies and candy bars. And and there are parents. The hotels are usually booked. The amount of tourism that the Arctic Winter Games brings into these specific communities is precedent. And for many of these communities, including our Alaskan communities, is the biggest tourist event that they have held. All of these communities that you see on your screen, at the end of the Arctic Winter Games, at the conclusion of that week, they had dollars left over. So even after they had paid all of their bills and costs associated with the Arctic Winter Games, they still had $50,000 to $100,000 left over that they were then allowed to be able to use to re-stimulate the economy by doing things like offering grants to the local Girl Scouts, by offering different programs and scholarships. So you can see that the Arctic Winter Games, while Alaska hosts it every 10 years, that trickle-down effect continues. We still experience it today. The Fairbanks 2014 Host Society has created a fund that's still benefiting individuals in Fairbanks. The Chugiak Eagle River still has their fund, and they're still granting on a regular basis. It's an exciting framework to think about for the Arctic Winter Games, and I really think is something that has an incredible amount of long-term investment. Particularly for this community, this could be an issue that this community could champion and really see the connection between the Arctic economic development and tourism. Any questions for me?
Any questions from the members? You're doing a splendid job.
All right. Let's talk about 2018. I just wanted to give you guys a quick update on where we're going. So 2018, we're going to be traveling to the Northwest Territories of Canada. The Arctic Winter Games are going to be held in the Slave Lake region. Our team is slotted to be comprised of 300 athletes, 50 volunteer coaches and chaperones. Can you imagine that? 50 coaches who are willing to sit on a bus or a plane for over 18 hours with their team, sleep on the floor of schools with their team that whole week. That's the amount of dedication to the Arctic Winter Games. Our volunteers are amazing. In fact, if you count our volunteers, since 1970, over 10,000 youth and adults have participated in some capacity in the Arctic Winter Games. This makes the Arctic Winter Games the largest international sporting event, even in-state the largest event that Alaska has participated in. It's paramount. It's not uncommon that you'll go to the grocery store and you'll see someone in an Arctic Winter Games jacket. And I'm sure even as I look around the room, you all have had some kind of a connection to Arctic Winter Games and the influence that it has had in people's lives. It's an exciting thing. So let's go really quick into the sports, because I know y'all are dying to know what the heck we do when we get to the Arctic Winter Games. So the sports can be divided into four categories. The first is traditional sports. So Arctic sports, Danny games, and dog mushing. And really, the traditional sports are the foundation of the Arctic Winter Games. This is an opportunity for our athletes to really compete at an international level, to learn culture and the way of playing the sport from different athletes that they never would have if they had stayed here in Alaska. We have a lot of amazing athletes in the traditional sport arena. And, you know, going through our list, I was amazed at how many Arctic and Dene athletes we have had compete at the Arctic Winter Games that go on to a national, international, and even world's level. And I just had a hard time choosing. So what I did was I picked out on the left-hand side, you'll see a picture of Nicole Johnson. Nicole Johnson is actually a board member now of the Arctic Winter Games. And she is an incredible athlete. She held the high jump world record for, oh my gosh, I want to say 30 years. It was just recently broken. She is incredible, and she still volunteers her time with Alaska Native youth across the state as a judge and a coach, helping and inspiring these kids to participate in their sport. And if you ask her what really lit her fire for her sport, she would tell you the Arctic Winter Games. And then on the right, we have, I don't know if you guys watch TV or not, but American Ninja Warrior. This young man, Nick Hansen, has been featured on the last two seasons of American Ninja Warrior. He lives in Unalakleet, and he has participated in the Arctic Winter Games for the past five game cycles. He, again, is an incredible athlete, an incredible mentor, particularly to the young up-and-coming athletes in our state. We're very blessed to have him on our team. So just an example of how Arctic Winter Games becomes an instrumental part of a developmental pipeline for our athletes. The second category of sports, so the first was Arctic sports, second category of sports is Nordic sports. Biathlon, ski, snowshoe, cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, snowboarding. And honestly, I could go on again about how many athletes we've had that have got their start in the Arctic Winter Games and now are Olympic gold medalists. Nina Kempel started with the Arctic Winter Games actually in snowshoeing, and she is an Olympic gold medalist. We've had two athletes, Kimberly and Amanda Del Frate, who were members of our biathlon cross-country ski team and then went on to compete in Worlds and medal in Worlds. Jay Hakkinen from Nikiski was a cross-country skier, competed at the Arctic Winter Games, and is an Olympic medalist as well. Indoor sports. Badminton, basketball, gymnastics, soccer, volleyball, and wrestling. Now, this one's kind of funny. When people ask me what sports are played at the Arctic Winter Games, they get very surprised when I say badminton and volleyball, because Arctic is not commonly associated with indoor sports. But sure enough, we do have a lot of athletes that participate in these sports, and they are very popular. Now, if this clip were to play, this is actually a clip of a soccer game that was taken in Nuuk at the 2016 Games in Greenland, and this is Team Alaska competing against the Nuuk soccer team, which is called futsal. In this particular clip, Team Alaska is scoring a goal, and you will be able to, and you could see the crowd just go wild. This arena that they are in was completely refurbished as a result of Nook Greenland bidding and hosting the Arctic Winter Games. So again, from that grant and stimulus money, they were able to revive this arena, and it now stands and is an incredible part of their community, in the center of their community. And of course, Greenlandic, they love their futsal, so it was a good show. The video doesn't play, but I hope I gave it justice. So Arctic sports, traditional sports, outdoor sports, indoor sports, and ice sports. Curling, figure skating, hockey, speed skating. Now, this is our 2014 figure skating team after they won the gold. And, you know, it's really an exciting opportunity to watch these young kids. The average age of our athletes is between 11 and 14, though we go to from 11 to 18. So for a lot of these kids, this is the first time they've been away from home. This is the first time they've competed without mom and dad in the crowd cheering them on. The role of our coaches is huge. And we're so fortunate to have incredible volunteer coaches who are willing to donate their time and energy. And, of course, culture. Culture is the foundation and paramount aspect of the Arctic Winter Games. You will see culture throughout the entire week. Any community that bids to host the Arctic Winter Games, they'll put on galas. There will be art shows. They will fly different performers in to be able to entertain not only the residents of that town, but the athletes that have come to visit. It's such an exciting display of Arctic culture, honoring the values and wisdom and tradition of the culture. For our Alaskan youth to see that value reiterated, not just from us as Alaskans, but from other countries as well, is so empowering. That their background, that their heritage, that their traditions are not only honored by us, but honored by the Greenlandic people and the Canadians and the Russians. It's awe-inspiring, and for many of our athletes, it's the first time that they have been able to see the breadth or depth of mark that their culture makes on other cultures as well. And again, just some beautiful photos of some of our cultural events, just exemplifying how much fun it is. It's a fun event. And so where is Team Alaska now? Where are our next steps? We are preparing to go to the Arctic Winter Games in March of 2018 in the Northwest Territories. I don't know if this information has been shared with the rest of the committee, but we as a team have always been supported by the state of Alaska, again, in 1970, when Governor Wally Hickel initiated Alaska as a full participating member in the Arctic Winter Games. This is the first year, us along with other nonprofits, we understand that we have not received any supporting funds to get our team to the Arctic Winter Games. We do our best. We will make the best out of the situation. We've been fundraising extensively. We have an incredible community of providers and supporters and private businesses that have donated. We will go to the Arctic Winter Games. But Team Alaska is in a position of trying to decide if we go to the Arctic Winter Games as a full team, our full 300 athletes, or if we have to reduce that team size, meaning we have to temporarily reduce some sports. It's a hard decision to make, one that we haven't yet fully made, but it is dependent upon our fundraising and dependent upon the support that we get from the legislature. Again, I just want to draw back to the fact that Arctic Winter Games is a huge economic stimulus for tourists, and for the long-term health and wellness of our state. We are the only participating contingent that does not receive support from our governing body in order to offset that international committee fee. Just to put a number in your head, that international committee fee is $37,500. So, it's not a lot, but it ensures that we remain participating members of the Arctic Winter Games. It ensures that we can continue to put our bid in to host the Arctic Winter Games. It ensures that Alaska, the state of Alaska, is continually at the table of the International Committee to make decisions around the future and progress and direction of the Arctic Winter Games. And also by being a participating member, it ensures that we are able to bring a full-size team of athletes and coaches. So that's our decision point right now. Again, we're fundraising, we're getting out there and doing as much outreach and working with our amazing volunteers and community members, but we have submitted a request to the legislature to help us with this $37,500 international committee fee, for the lack of better words.
Okay, Ms. Reams, I do appreciate that, and thank you for sharing it. This has been wonderful, and I think I can speak for all of us. It seems like the colder the temperatures, the warmer the people, wherever we go. With that in mind, and getting you all in here before I get any further, Speaker Edgeman came in at 1:59, and thank you, sir.
Yes, thank you for talking kindly about the people of Southwest Alaska.
And what I do is as you're talking about the $38,500, has there been a portion that the state has been paying before, or do they pay it in whole? How did that work?
So the state in the past has given us various sums of money, but much larger than that. We've received anywhere from $150,000 to $200,000. All of that money was used to offset the expense of transporting our athletes to the games. So those dollars, if you want to say a direct dollar-for-dollar transfer, were used for the charter of the plane.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? There are none. As my prerogative, I see that we have the president here online, and it's Sarah Shrampton. Ms. Shrampton, I'm going to put you on the line if you'd like to address us as well.
Wanted to thank you for your time and for allowing us to come in and do this presentation, and I apologize I couldn't be there myself, but Katie did a great job explaining what we do and what our mission is as the Arctic, or as Team Alaska Arctic Winter Games, and if there are any questions, I welcome any for myself or for Katie.
Okay, well, thank you, ma'am, and I think this has been a fabulous presentation, and you know the state of our finances right now, but this really is something worth pursuing, and I thank you for your time and this presentation. I know it's difficult coming to Juneau sometimes and doing something like this, and asking for something like this is always hard, regardless of who you are. So I appreciate the efforts. I appreciate the work you do, and I'm sure we all do, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Westlake and members of the committee, for your time today.
And with that, I will be calling ANTHC, Michael Black, up here and introduce yourself. And please, I just reminded myself, no acronyms, and could you explain what ANTHC is? Thank you. Yes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and fellow committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak a little bit about what the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is doing in regards to sanitation. As you might be aware, we have a lot of broad responsibilities for the public health of Alaska Native populations throughout the state. And what I would like to speak to you today about is preventative health care, actually, sanitation, rural sanitation primarily, and some of the challenges that involves. Now, if I can see about, whoop, I just took me out of it. I'm sorry.
Well, that was easy.
That was easy, right?
At ease.
Once again, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is a organization with a vision, and our vision is that eventually we get to the point where the Alaska Native people are the healthiest people in the world. That in part involves health care, obviously, but it also involves the living conditions within rural Alaska. We would prefer that individuals are allowed to continue to live in the regions and the communities that they have historically lived in and be able to maintain public health to the best that we can find. And in part of that is actually being able to provide rural sanitation. What are the issues in rural sanitation today? I think, first of all, I think affordability and the adaptation of infrastructure is extremely critical. Now, for the benefit of the committee, I should say that my position is Director of Community Infrastructure Development, and that I'm with the Division of Environmental Health and Engineering. ANTHC, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, is a large organization. The Division of Environmental Health and Engineering is primarily engineers, operation maintenance specialists, and supporting staff that are charged with providing sanitation and critical infrastructure to public health in rural Alaska. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is made up of a board. That board is representative of all the regions of the state and are represented through the regional health organizations that are across the state. We, as Division of Environmental Health and Sanitation, have a number of responsibilities. You might see sanitation, of course, operation and maintenance, environmental health. We also help the regional health organizations actually operate their hospitals and clinics. We have an organization of which the chair is very familiar, and that's the Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative, which is a group of 26 communities that we help operate and maintain water and sewer for their benefit, and if that's a voluntary organization. So we allows us to have real-life experience with actually operating water and sewer, not just building it. And finally, the other aspect of our work in rural sanitation is actually the energy program. The reason that energy is critical is because of its influence on the affordability of water and sewer in rural Alaska. And we'll cover that a little later in the presentation. This gives you some idea of the breadth of activities that we have. We share responsibility with the state of Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation through the Village Safe Water Program, the provision of water and sewer in rural Alaska. It's a more or less 50-50 responsibility between ourselves and Department of Environmental Conservation. We use Indian Health Service funding, as well as EPA funding and USDA funding, as well as State of Alaska funding to provide rural sanitation infrastructure. I would first like to talk to you a little bit about what we're doing to protect infrastructure that's currently in place. The quotes on this slide came from a 2007 study done by the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska, basically saying whatever we do to maintain infrastructure that is currently in place and make sure that it doesn't prematurely degrade makes economic sense. Because from the standpoint of being able to replace it, it represents billions of dollars of investment currently in place, and if we can extend that the life of that infrastructure, it is in everybody's interest, certainly in the community's interest, as well as any of the funding organizations, including the state of Alaska. So let's look at some of the challenges that infrastructure is currently being put under. First, we have, for those that are familiar with rural Alaska, have been out, you may see pipes where we are providing pipe water and sewer. They're connected to the homes, and because of the warming environment, we're seeing differential settling between the pipe and the structure that it's connected to, whether it be a residence or whether it be a community building. And in the pictures you see, the reason for the destruction that's very obvious is because the pipe has settled at a differential rate from the foundation of the building. And in doing that, it stresses the pipe and rips apart the Arctic insulation, as well as, in some cases, actually pulling the pipe and the building's wall right off the side of the structure itself. The reason is obviously the weight of the building, more importantly the pipe, as it drops in some cases feet, number of feet in relation to where it was with the building. So let's take a look at what we've been able to do to try to deal with that. And this is very common even in communities such as Bethel, Kotzebue, and others. Any building on permafrost is subject to this type of stress. What you see here is a drawing of a flexible connection that will allow the pipe to actually rotate in relation to the building it's connected to. This will prevent the building, the pipe itself, from pulling at the wall and tearing away the insulation that protects it. The way that looks on the ground, and these are some homes in Sivunga, which we put this flexible connection in, the blue pattern that you see on the pipe is actually a flex pipe that allows that main pipeline, that service line, to actually move and avoid the damage that you saw. One other aspect of this I would like to point out is once that damage is done on the traditional Arctic box connection, that becomes a freeze point for the water and sewer, especially the water, because of the insulation being deteriorated. So at that stage, then the house actually can lose all water service because the insulation's been removed and it's subjected to well below zero temperatures in many cases. So this is a innovation that we developed, and we're now considering this to be our standard. We're finding a great deal of interest from regional housing authorities and from other communities to try to retrofit the more traditional Arctic box with this type of connection to avoid those types of issues. In fact, I just had a conversation with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. They have the same issues in Bethel with some of their homes, and they're interested in looking at this as a possibility. The other thing that we see is this structural issue. As you can see in the pictures on the left, it's actually a water tank that is leaning, and that is because the permafrost below that tank is actually degraded. And on the right-hand side, it's a little less obvious, but you can see a building there with thermopiles, which is the traditional way of cooling the foundations. You see it, for example, on the Alaska Pipeline. That was one of the innovations that made the Alaska Pipeline possible. Well, thermosiphons depend on the air temperature being cold enough to transmit that cold into the permafrost below. What we are seeing, especially in the Yukon and Kuskokwim Delta now, is that the air temperatures are too warm for the thermopiles to work properly. What that then does is put high-valued infrastructure at risk of foundation failures. Here you see a water plant that has been subjected to a substantial degrading of the foundation, and that is not bad photography. That is actually the foundation failing on the south side of the building and actually stressing, sinking in part, just like a boat almost, into the ground, which of course is stressing all that pipe and the other infrastructure. The foundation itself cracked, and it put at risk a water plant with a value of $3 to $4 million. Here is how we're addressing that, and this is a drawing, which the slide doesn't fully show you, but I'll try to explain it. Underneath, you see the ice represented by a graphic. Below it are glycol lines that will be carrying chilled glycol from a chiller in the room to the left. You see a box represented there. That's a chiller. That chiller will be demanding electricity, which will be provided by the solar panels. That will then work just like a refrigerator to refreeze the foundation below this building. And we are at this stage, this summer, going to put in a prototype that relies upon this approach to save a building, a relatively new building in Quinnahock. If we don't do something about the foundation and the permafrost below it, right now it's showing us 31.5 degrees temperature last summer. So it's just at the point where it becomes liquid. And when that happens, a building no more than 4 or 5 years old would be compromised. So this is another innovation that we're pioneering. If our work in Quinnahock appears to work, we have plans to put this in a number of villages. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
So, Mike, this building you said is only 3 or 4 years old. I have to ask a question. How could this foundation be approved?
And the foundation,
who installed it?
The foundation itself was solid when it was originally designed. The problem has been that we've spent 3 or 4 summers in particular that have been much warmer than normal. And this, by the way, depends on buildings that actually have thermosiphons. So this building does have thermosiphons. So it was intended to keep that permafrost solid. But what's happened is the air temperature has gotten warmer. And the permafrost is actually warmed up to the point where it's right at the stage of failing. You see almost in all the high-valued real estate, at least, or high-valued buildings in the YK Delta, which is considered warm permafrost, almost all of them are using thermopiles as a way of attempting to keep that foundation solid. But air temperatures have had an effect. Now, the other thing that's happened in some of these buildings is if we're not careful about the slab going on grade and the type of surface that we put it on, you can get premature failing as well from just not having proper fill below a foundation like that. So there's a number of issues working, but one thing we believe we can do is be able to refreeze this permafrost for high-valued buildings. Another innovation that is in the process, and some of you have flyers in front of you, I think all of you have flyers in front of you that talk about this this development. This is a in-home sanitation system, which in Dean's district, we've put this in Kivalina in 9 homes. We are testing it. It is a prototype. It's certainly not something that we consider to be finished, but we are trying to work those bugs out. But what this does is it replaces the honey bucket, and it puts in place a a waste management system that allows separation of solid and liquid waste streams, and therefore cuts out a lot of the health problems of dealing with honey buckets. It also provides additional water to the home without having to pipe it using a centralized water system. And this relies upon water catchment or rainwater catchment as well as self-hauled water. The illustration on your left shows an elevated water tank. That's a 100-gallon water tank that an individual homeowner can actually get water from the water plant and haul it to the house and pump it up. There's a electric pump or hand pump, either one, and pump it up into that storage tank. Then it would becomes available to the household through a low-flow fixtures. More importantly is if a home chooses to do something more traditional, like gathering ice or river water, it actually has a in-stream pipe filtering system and chlorinator that allows, even with river water collection, to provide potable water to the home. Now, this is not in the quantities anywhere close that a piped water sewer system can, but it also doesn't rely upon a community-wide piped water and sewer system, which has its own benefits, as you know, from the standpoint of affordability. These systems run the homeowner about $30 a month to operate, as opposed to what you would see a much higher rate in a normal community water and wastewater system.
If I may, Mike. Now one of the things we had done when we were doing this was going to be looking at the hospital records to see about health associated illnesses. Has there been any report back about these things?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Mr. Chairman. This system relies upon a air handling to remove odor. An air handling system is very small. It's about a half horsepower motor that ventilates the collection area below the toilet, as seen in this illustration. The solid portion of the waste stream actually is collected in that container below the toilet, and the liquid portion goes into a distribution system underneath the home. And it's a disinfected because in Kivalina we have salt water, brackish water, groundwater, which disinfects the urine stream. But the solid portion, because we have obviously odors related to that, we use an air handling system that vents the air up around the eaves of the house. What we have shown from that is that we did air quality monitoring in the house itself and had substantial improvements in the air quality as well, which we know is a big problem in rural Alaska because of overcrowding of homes. We see high levels of carbon dioxide particulate matters, and we've seen a large amount of respiratory disease issues related to air quality in homes themselves. And in fact, we did a study recently of infants that had been repeatedly admitted to the hospital, released once they were seemed to be over the respiratory illness, but to return only 6 months later. We called this a frequent flyer syndrome. We put individuals into the home to test air quality and to try to address that. And what we saw was if we can better ventilate homes and if we can deal with the particulate problems of wood stoves, we can substantially decrease that amount of rehospitalization, both of elders as well as infants. This is Bob Sagonis from Life Water Engineering in Fairbanks. He was one of our collaborators. We had the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, the Life Water, and the Cabin Water Systems all collaborate with our engineers to develop this system. And for those that are interested in seeing this, we have a prototype built at our facility in Anchorage for anyone that's interested to see how this thing actually looks.
And if I may, I think there's a YouTube video on the same thing, if I remember correctly.
That's correct. Okay. And we have, yes, if you go on the YouTube and either Kivalino or ANTHC, you'll be able to see this in operation. Plus, you'll be able to see interviews with the homeowners. I must say that the system, we just finished a report. Some of you may have a copy of that. I brought that down a couple of weeks ago, but if you don't, I can certainly get you a copy. But it includes resolutions from both city and tribe supporting more deployment of these types of systems in Kivalino. We are intending to do that if we can find the federal funding to do so.
Okay.
Affordability is a different issue, but it is equally important. If we're going to provide sanitation, we have to have affordable systems, and many of those are costly to the homeowner. What we discovered was that the easiest way to address the cost of operating was through trying to deal with energy efficiency. And we work very closely with the Alaska Energy Authority when things such as the Renewable Energy Fund were still available. And we worked with AHFC as well on the energy efficiencies. All that paid major benefits to rural Alaska communities as far as the affordability of water and sewer. Why is that? Well, here, this pie chart shows you the cost of running water and sewer in rural Alaska has a great deal to do with the cost of energy. As you might imagine, you can't keep water flowing if it's frozen. So heat is the most important aspect of energy consumption. We use electricity as well, of course, for pumps. But heat is by far the most important aspect of the energy budget. So here's how we approached the energy efficiency issue. We did so through renewable energy and through energy efficiency projects. I listed here three of the major ways of using renewable energy. One is biomass, which is obviously a collection locally of wood that can be used to provide the heat we're talking about. That also provides an opportunity for local jobs. And we've been able to use that successfully using boiler systems, wood-burning boiler systems. Heat recovery is by far the easiest and the best way of getting wasted heat into our water system. And Tesla could tell you about the requirements of battery development. Actually, the best battery in the world is sitting right there in the water tank. 1 million gallons of water is a great way to store energy. And every degree we bring that water up is less that we have to heat when we push it out through the pipe and into the community, or we're drawing water from a distant source. So heat recovery from everything from the electric generators, which are obviously always available somewhere in the community. The question is how far away it is from the water plant, that being the main concern. The other part of that is the wind to heat. Any wind turbines that have been built in rural Alaska obviously are producing a great deal of electricity at times of low demand, high wind conditions, and at night they simply take that excess heat and blow it into the atmosphere. What we do, especially working with organizations such as the Alaska Village Electric Co-op, is we buy that heat at a much reduced rate and put it into our water plant and our water storage tanks. Energy efficiency for the dollar spent is the best investment. Energy efficiency can produce more benefit per dollar spent than even the renewable energy area. So This is an example of our Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative, that 26 communities that we run water and sewer on. And after, before and after we put the energy efficiency and renewable energy projects in some of those communities, you can see the decline in total fuel use. You can also see the total decline in budget, the cost of fuel for those 26 communities. It's pretty remarkable. And if, again, it just proves that we can make sanitation more affordable if we're thoughtful about how we deal with energy. So who benefits from this energy conservation? I'd like to point out to you that the beneficiary includes the state of Alaska through the Power Cost Equalization Program. Mm-hmm. So there's of the total level of benefit, 34% of those benefits go to the state of Alaska's budget. And there are also savings, obviously, for the community in both the form of fuel as well as electric. Here's the approach we take. We go in and we put a group of engineers and O&M specialists into the plant. They analyze the situation, make recommendations, and then we put those recommendations into a descending order of cost benefit. We try to find funding for the highest benefit per cost, and then we monitor the plant afterwards through remote monitoring programs, because without remote monitoring, many of these benefits may go away and no one would be aware of it, unless, you know, because it does require you to operate the system. Here's an example of the biomass system. I think everybody can understand this, is that we're essentially substituting fuel oil boilers for wood-fired boilers, with fuel oil boilers being the backup if anything happens or disrupts our ability to harvest wood or to be able to feed the boiler. So Elam is one of the examples, and this is an example of a community that's saving over $83,000 annually from using locally available wood and producing jobs doing the same at the same time. So this $83,000 doesn't include the money that we're spending on local labor to collect wood. And I might say that I spent a number of years with the state of Alaska's Department of Commerce. We did everything we could to create local jobs in rural Alaska. This was the easiest one we could do to create local jobs. The other one, as mentioned, is renewable energy and heat recovery. Again, it's very easy to see that that's a no-brainer. We ought to be doing that in every case. Otherwise, it's just wasted energy. Deering put in a heat recovery system, and again, this amounted to saving each household $150 per month in costs that otherwise somebody would have to pay for water and sewer. And then renewable energy, the wind to heat program, is another one of that we should always be looking at that opportunity, because the wind turbines are turning regardless of whether there's demand there. The easiest way to store that energy, in fact, maybe the only way at this point, reliably at least. I know battery development technology has come a long ways, but the easiest is the water storage tank. McCoryuk is using that, and we buy the electricity at 5 cents a kilowatt hour, significantly below market, and they've saved $40,000 annually in their operating costs. Selawik we went through a energy efficiency program there where we changed out old pumps, just changed the operation of the water plant itself. As you can see, the O&M savings, that's over $200,000 a year in savings to that community. And again, I think there are other opportunities out there like Selawik. With that, Hopefully I've been able to give you some idea of what we're doing. And if you're interested, I have additional material here as well. And then we have a number of websites that you can go to, one of which is identified on this slide.
Well, thank you for that, Mike. We, as you see, we were running 2 hours late behind, so we got some people had to go to different committees. I appreciate that. Do you have any questions, Representative?
I don't think so, although, through the chair, I would like to talk to you sometime, Mike, about your original slides where you spoke to the impacts of climate on energy efficiency and the types of things you're working on. It's a topic of interest of mine. And if you're in town this evening, there's a bill on the creation of a climate change commission and grant funding that will be heard, I believe, in state affairs down the hall. And we would welcome your testimony, for sure.
I will be in town, and I will certainly attend.
It's at 5:30.
Thank you.
Yes, and speaking from experience from both sides over here, climate change is expensive, so we've certainly had that. So thank you, Mr. Black. I do appreciate your time and coming down here. This is wonderful work you're doing, and I wanted the state to recognize it and keep it up. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and we did have one last item of business out here, and it was going to be House Joint Resolution 9, and it's the Arctic Marine Safety Agreements, but to be more efficient, we're going to hold that until Thursday. Then we're going to have both invited and public testimony out here. So, having concluded the scheduled business for today's meeting, and it's now, oh goodness, it is now 2:37. I adjourn this meeting.